Hello, and welcome to Making the Museum. I'm Jonathan Alger, and this is a project of C&G Partners, Design for Culture. Today, I am joined by Regina Bain and Sarah Caples. Regina and Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks, dear Jonathan.
So to get started, for those who don't know you like I know you, could you each tell our listeners who you are and what you do? Maybe we'll start with Regina.
Hi, everybody. I'm Regina Bain. I'm the executive director of the Louis Armstrong House Museum in Queens.
And Sarah, how about you?
Greetings. I'm Sarah Caples. I'm one of the founding principals of Caples Jefferson Architects. Among other things, we have the privilege of being the architects for the new Louis Armstrong Center.
All right. Full disclosure, we've got the director of the Louis Armstrong House Museum and the Louis Armstrong Center. We have the architect of the latter, the Louis Armstrong Center, and I am from the firm that did the exhibition design for the new center. So we've got a little jazz trio happening here. I'm very curious, and it's my favorite side question, how you each got into this business. Origin stories are listeners' favorite thing. So Regina, how did you get into this business?
Oh my goodness. Whenever there's an origin story, I always have to start with my mother and her love of art and how she passed that love to me. I studied theater and African-American studies. I went on to the School of Drama, Yale School of Drama, to study theater. And I've always just been involved around art, history, education, storytelling. And so when the opportunity came to be a part of this, it was a way to put both all of those pieces of me together. Art, history, storytelling, it's the best. And so I got here by dreaming that and then speaking that aloud to a friend who said, I think I know a place that might be great for you to check out. So I'm thankful to my dreams. I'm thankful to my mother for putting those dreams to me. And I'm thankful to my friend for helping me manifest them.
Wow. Okay. So listeners, if you have a dream, speak it aloud to a friend.
Here.
Sarah, how about you? How did you find your way into this business and what you do today?
That's so interesting, Regina. So I started to think about architecture as a teenager, but I didn't even think of it as something that I could do as a woman. And I was in a, you know, carpool ride and discussed it with one of the adults who said, why don't you do the whole thing? And so your idea of sharing that, you're saying how important it is to share a dream, absolutely, that gave me the gumption to go through a lot of twists and turns to get to be an architect. And now for the past 35 years, practicing with my partners, Everardo Jefferson, who founded the firm, and Michael Berman, who we've practiced with for over 20 years.
Wow. I think we need to start again and retitle this entire podcast episode to be about Speak Your Dreams to a Friend. I'm just going to drop the microphone right there. Thank you, listeners. It's been great to have you. We're done here. All right. I have jest. Let's get right into this. So here we go. Today's episode is the new Louis Armstrong Center with Regina Bain and Sarah Caples. As always, I have the list and my guests have the rest. Today, we have 8 chapters if listeners want to keep track. And chapter number 1 is Louis and Lucille's House. Let our listeners know what it is. Regina, can you describe briefly what the Louis Armstrong House Museum is and why it is that there needed to be a new center, a new building?
Yes. So we have to begin with Louis Armstrong. Born in New Orleans at the turn of the century in the reverberations of slavery and through civil rights, Jim Crow era, he was a trumpet player. And he was also a vocalist. And he became America's first Black popular music icon. Jazz, popular music, films, over 35 films. He was the first African-American to have featured billing in a Hollywood film. He was one of the first to have written in his contract that he would not stay in a hotel that he could not play at, thinking about the laws of segregation. He was a pioneer. He was a musical genius. He was an amazing member of our Queens community. So he was born in New Orleans, but he lived for 30 years in Corona, Queens on 107th Street. And that house is now our historic house. But I have to mention another name, and that is Lucille Armstrong, his wife. Lucille is the person who purchased the home with her own money from being a dancer at the Cotton Club. And she made that life for them. And then after they passed, she willed that home to the city of New York for it to become our museum. And so thank you to Lewis for his amazing legacy that made this. And also thank you to Lucille for preserving the legacy, for making sure it became a landmarked home. So now we do guided tours through that historic house and have done that since 2003. And it's been an amazing adventure. But there came time when we wanted to do more, when we wanted to do more to put forward this legacy and do programs. But it's a historic house. You have to protect the house. You can't have 100 people inside doing different programs. So we needed another space. And that space was put into dreaming many, many decades ago by community members, by leaders of the museum. And there was an article in 1999 in the Queens College newsletter that said, with the help of the Louis Armstrong Educational Foundation, across the street from the historic home has been purchased a plot of land, and on it will be built what we have today. So it took a while, but we're here. And it's because of the historic house and because of Louis Armstrong's legacy.
We are recording in March of 2024. So there is some time that's gone by. And of course, you also have a great archive, archivists, et cetera, that are also in the center. We'll talk a little bit about what is in the center. But next chapter, chapter two, is the title of chapter two is We'll Open in 3 Months. So that's something I know Regina was told to you when you started. But Sarah, I want to turn over to you for the real timeline. When you got involved in designing this building and getting it dreamed up and drawn up and bid up and built up from a hole in the ground across the street, what is the total timeline? And what's your secret to keeping it going for as long as I think you had to?
So start going backwards. Secret, sheer stubbornness and never giving up. But that's because we were working on something that was so cool, and a building to house Lewis, to house exhibits, a collection, live performances are focused around the legacy of Lewis Armstrong. That's worth the approximately 17 years that we were part of that journey. Well, so, and I'm dating till the opening last summer. So, of course, there's still little things, little tune-ups, but that's essentially the timeline in a nutshell. Right? So how did that evolve for us? Well, first, that 1999 to about 2004, that first 5 years, I think, was really a lot of homework, and I can't even begin to imagine how many meetings where the institution got the city and the state behind it to fund the construction of the new center. And so that was the first thing that had to happen before we came on board. Then the state, the Dormitory Authority of the State of New York, did an advertisement, and something like 44 different firms competed to be the architect. And there were actually 3 rounds of selection. It was a long competitive process, and we sought one that required thinking about really what the vision of the building should be, not so much trying to design it as trying to think what the essence was that we needed to respond to, and kind of sharing those conversations with the museum as we were allowed to mate.
So 17 years and stubbornness is the secret. Now, my firm, C&G Partners, we got involved in the project doing the exhibition planning and design after you were, some time after you were, and went through a process similar to yours, and we were on
twice.
Board for numbers.
We
competed twice. We were given the project twice. I'm not even sure how that's possible, but we were given it twice, and we did it once. But then, after that, Regina arrived on the scene, and it's when you arrived that I think you said that the trustees told you, we'll be open in 3 months, if I remember
that
correctly.
Was August of 2020.
Right. This turned out to be not exactly precisely true.
Not precise, no. It took, instead of 3 months, it took 3+ years. We got there. And what I learned in that time is how to listen and trust instincts. I did not know when I was hired that I would be on so many construction calls and in the midst of that process, but we did it. And now we have this amazing building. And Jonathan, you started to hint to what's in the building. But just to let everybody know, this building has a jazz club. And I love how it came to have a jazz club. Through our architect's vision for what that space could be, they helped it to become a jazz club. It has an amazing multimedia exhibit that Jonathan talked about, building that was curated by Jason Moran, amazing pianist and visual artist. And of course, it has the Armstrong Archives, the 60,000-piece Armstrong Archive that was at Queens College and now is right across the street from the historic house. So accessible. And so rooted, we exist because Lewis and Lucille made sure that we existed. They kept things. They honored their history and their legacy. It's because they did that we're here today. And it's all right now on the block in this beautiful space.
Can you tell, before I forget, can you tell our listeners how to get there? You have to be in New York City, but what's the best way to get there? What's the closest, subway stop, bus stop, what have you?
Come to New York City. We're very close to LaGuardia Airport.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We come from around the world. And you land in New York City. You can take the 7 train to 103rd Street, Corona. And then you walk about 10, 12 minutes from there. We're in a neighborhood. We're so thankful to our neighbors and our community. But come on over. We'd love to see you.
Awesome. So let's talk about that building a little bit. Chapter 3. A golden curve. So that kind of expresses part of the building that Sarah and her partner Everardo worked on. It's quite a beautiful building, quite out of the ordinary in its neighborhood, yet totally in place. Sarah, can you describe the curves of the building and the color of the building? It is a very, very modern looking building. When people take that 7 train and find their way, like Regina just suggested, they will find something quite beautiful. Tell us a little bit about where those inspirations came from and what the building's like.
So I think being conscious of a neighborhood, that walk from the subway, the fact that it's a real people neighborhood, that is something that sets you up for the experience of the building. The building is mid-block. It's not in a monumental location. It's slightly catty-corner from across the street from Lewis's house. And when we, in our many meetings with the staff, with the neighborhood, with trustees, almost everyone, especially people from the neighborhood, talked about what a beacon, what an incredible experience it was to live in a neighborhood inhabited by one of America's greatest musical geniuses ever, and how it was so much a part of Louis Armstrong's character to be so down to earth and to go to the local barbershop and to meet with people. And so the idea of this genius in the neighborhood was the thing that started to drive our design sensibility, that it should be at the scale of the neighborhood, but that it should stand out also as to announce the extraordinary presence of this great creative. And so we started to look at things like, what did Lewis surround himself with? Well, of course, the most noted things were his musical instruments. That was the core of his, the core objects of his creation. So we did start to look at that among many other things. And the curbs, the canopy that create a little urban forecourt are all to signal this. And not only across the street, but that subway approach, that neighborhood approach, people are coming to the building sideways, down the street, up the street. And so it announces itself softly, even when you're seeing it from that oblique view. And that's important.
I like that people are coming to the building sideways. I think I came to my career sideways. The building is in fact golden. It's literally golden. It has a gold color. And when I ask people, why do you think Louis Armstrong, a building about Louis Armstrong is gold? I'm always pleasantly surprised to hear that people say it's because of his trumpet. He had a gold trumpet. You know, as Regina was suggesting before, he had quite a few gold records in the sense of being very popular, right? So that's all woven in there, right, Sarah? That's where these inspirations come from. In our business, we get to encode the story into the design, right? That's one of the cool things that we can do.
Very much so. And so several of the materials, the underside of the canopy that you look up at is brass, instrument quality brass. The glass is... We didn't want to have something, we wanted to have something transparent that changes affect during the day, but that also is different. And we embedded a custom designed woven golden mesh, brass mesh, into the glass. And for the sustainable techies out there, that also helps to provide a lot of cooling. Keeps the building sustainable. The building, even after 17 years, qualified for a LEED Silver rating, even though it was based on two versions of LEED prior to the present, which gives you some idea of how committed all involved were to making this a building that honors Lewis's legacy, not only with the kind of visual images and those kinds of experiences, which are really important, but also in the fundamentals of the building's construction and creation, that it honor that presence on so many levels.
And the building is, I was going to, some people say that building is built like a pocket watch. It's just precise and tucked in. I'm going to say this building is built like a trumpet. It's golden, it's curvilinear. It's precisely built. There's details packed into it at every corner, and beautiful music comes out of it. Chapter number four, serious acting. Regina, you hinted before in your, when I put you on the spot and said, tell us, give us your origin story, that you have a background in acting, the Yale Dramat, the School of Drama. And as I've gotten to know you, I know that you, I have actually seen you literally wield that skill in a spontaneous public situation to my amazement. And I am sure there are many other situations where that skill has come into play. Would you recommend to other people that they should take some acting classes if they're going to do what you do? And how has that background made you who you are now?
Take all the acting classes, folks. You have to know how to parlay that. But I love artists. I love art. I think that it is a basis for understanding humanity. I think that studying form and story and language and color helps us to listen to one another and helps us solve problems. I believe in arts. And I learned that. I learned those skills while studying acting. I learned what it meant to stand in front of someone, to have something that I wanted, to know there was something that they wanted, goals that they were looking for, and we were in the structure of a scene, and how we dance together and listen to one another to convey that to an audience. That is, those are skills that are extremely helpful for leadership, for going into challenging situations and being able to listen carefully to what people are saying, what they need, what those competing needs are, and making a dance that comes out for an audience. That is what I did in this process. That is what actors do. And I loved it. I loved that training because it truly continues to help me today. So everybody go to acting class, but just know what you're going there for. Don't do it just because. You have to know why you're there. It's been a great learning process for me to enter into this position as in this amazing moment of change and be able to help us walk through that change.
Huh. Until you said that, I hadn't really thought about it that way, because I've seen you do things in front of an audience extemporaneously that I was amazed by, but it didn't occur to me, it should have, that it's the underlying foundation of that. It's the improvisational quality of the relationship of two actors on stage, or the ability to be able to take when they give and give when they take, and all of that that lies underneath it that makes you, as you just said, you have to be a good listener to be a good actor.
Definitively.
It's not the thing you see, it's the thing you don't see them doing that's making an actor be good at what they do. And that's something that you wield as well.
It's the bedrock rehearsal of walking into uncertain situations with clear goals and coming out the other side.
But that's in the spirit of Lewis and Jason Moran, our guest curator, we also have to encourage people to take music classes as well, right? We need to slip
take all
that
the
in.
Arts. All the arts.
The arts.
Visual art, dance, do it all. Do it all.
I did all those things and I completely agree with you, but I've already drunk the Kool-Aid. All right. Terrific. Okay, we're halfway through. Let me do a quick station identification. If you're just joining, you are listening to Making the Museum. I'm Jonathan Alger, and this is a project of C&G Partners, Design for Culture. If you find this show valuable, please help spread the word. You can rate the show in Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can write a review in Apple Podcasts. And thank you to everyone who has made this show a 5-star podcast. If you want to give one of those 1-star reviews, just go to some other podcast and do that. You can also just tell a friend to check out makingthemuseum.com for everything about this podcast and its sister weekly newsletter. Now back to the show. Today, I'm talking to Regina Bain and Sarah Caples about the new Louis Armstrong Center. So we've done chapters 1 through 4. We got 4 left. That must mean that we are up to chapter 5. And here we are, chapter 5, The Reverberations Matter. Regina, you are a font of interesting and mysterious words to live by. The reverberations matter. Tell us about that poetry and what that means in your practice leading this institution.
So we're founded in music, in a musical legacy, and I've always imagine what it would have been like to have Louis Armstrong playing in his home, standing on the terrace, playing trumpet for the community, and just how that echoes, how it echoes and echoes and billows through the air, and what it means for that sound to billow through time, for those thoughts and those dreams and those that legacy to billow through time, and that we are receiving the echoes from those reverberations right now. And how do we keep it going to not deaden the sound? We can't deaden it. It can't stop with us. How do we keep it going? And for me, that is in the program that we do and how we shepherd this legacy and get ready to pass the baton, the reverberative baton to whoever is coming after us. So literally, we had trumpet players on the terrace during in the opening. There were, I think, 12 trumpet players, some who were on terrace of the historic home, some on the terrace of the new center, and they were playing to one another in this sonic connection. But then also programmatically, it means for me thinking, living in the Armstrong values with what we do. So it is continuing to preserve the house and the archives, but also the values of education, making sure there are always young people who are coming through our doors, that we're going to schools. Exactly. And that was actually the very first program that happened. Pops is Tops, children's concert in the garden. Back in the 80s, before we were officially open as a museum, we did concerts for kids. We've been doing that for 37 years. So that's bedrock. Artistic excellence. So making sure contemporary artists are performing in our spaces, are taking advantage of the archive, and community. And community for us is both local and global. It means knowing that Louis Armstrong, Louis and Lucille were two Black artists who owned their own home. How can we tell that story and do program around that now? And knowing that Louis traveled to over 65 countries, how can we go there and bring those stories back? So that's the reverberation for me. Reverberation through continuing the legacy and through the program.
Sarah, this is kind of a spontaneous question, but Regina just described an event at the opening.
Yes.
Where we had, they weren't just, you know, 12 trumpet players who just say, hey, do you play trumpet? Come on over. These were like 12 of the preeminent Brooklyn trumpet players
greatest
in the world
players.
Who were all themselves
absolutely
honored to be asked to play some lines of Louis Armstrong. They were also asked to play one of the hardest solos ever written by anybody that Louis,
right,
you know, invented, and really hard to follow in his footsteps. But there was a moment there where they were all playing in unison across the street from the terrace of,
yes,
the to the terrace of the building you designed.
Yes,
where right above them was that instrument grade brass, that curving facade, the
true
golden hue above that custom made golden mesh that's bringing that sustainability to it. How did you feel? Because I was watching you. I was there too. And I was watching you in the middle of the road. You and Everardo were standing there. How the heck did you feel after 17 years?
What a rush. What an incredible feeling to have your building participate in this incredible celebration, this incredible music. It was so satisfying. And it was such a long journey. So Regina was talking a little bit earlier about the jazz room. So of course, when we got the project, there had been a preliminary attempt at listing, describing the spaces that the building should contain. And there was this always frightening description to me, something called a multi-purpose room. And it's the old, you know, Saturday Night Live joke of it's a floor wax and a dessert topping. It's like this, and you've seen so many of these spaces, and you've been to weddings or award ceremonies or whatever, and hotels with movable partitions in it. You could be anywhere and nowhere. So that's not a way to celebrate Louis, right? And so we wanted a place. We asked the then executive director, Michael Coxwell, Regina's predecessor, Michael, what if we turned this into a jazz room? And to his credit, he just went nuts in a great way over the idea. And we ended up going to jazz clubs all over Manhattan and really trying to get a sense of what a room for about 75 people would be. And we gave it a special shape. We gave it special colors. Of course, the acoustics had to be great for both reinforced sound and live sound. And we did everything we could think of to make this room a special place for music, but you never know. You never know till you hear the sound. Thank you, Arup, the acoustical engineers. They were wonderful. And then what kind of music gets created there? Well, thanks to Regina and her crew, what miracles of jazz we hear all the time from the open rehearsals and lessons, that core that you talked about, Regina, of the kids learning to play the trumpet, to incredible jazz concerts. The opening one was, of course, Jason Moran, curator of the exhibit, and brilliant jazz pianist, jazz performers whose jazz, a Cuban trumpeter, whose jazz kind of bridges to the primarily now Hispanic neighborhood, to their residents, and shares something that brings people into the present, or incredible experiments like, Regina, you had Esmeralda Spalding come, yep, and she worked with your fellowship. So the museum has this amazing fellowship every year, or I'm not probably using the right word.
I'm strong now. That's perfect.
And it's both musical performers and dance performers, which Regina, that honors the legacies of both Lewis and Lucille. Do I have that right?
And Lucille, and beyond, it's visual artists. We've had multiple, right. It's multidisciplinary.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible. So here we are in this concert, and Esmeralda Spalding works with the dancers and the audience to integrate dance back into contemporary jazz performance. It's the most mind-blowingly wonderful thing. And it's a space that allows artists, whether they're that kid blowing the trumpet for the first time, or these great contemporary artists, allowing them to try something that they might not try if they had to sell 1,000 tickets.
Esperanza Spalding and Antonio Brown, they had us be joyous in that space. It was hot. We were dancing so much. We started with the fans. It felt like you were in the parade. It was hot. But the philosophy underneath it, wondering why the word jazz as it relates to dance has been separated from the word jazz as it relates to music. What did that happen? And having that be the philosophical underpinning. So this room is able to encompass sound and thought. And that's what I love about what we've been able to create. There was a concert, I think it was the Jason Moran concert, and there was someone who was there in the audience and has asked her, how was it? And she said, it felt like being inside a cello.
Mm.
So
that's the room itself. You built. That's the room you built.
Yep.
The music within that room made her feel like being inside of a cello.
So there are all these kind of magical materials disposed in very specific ways, from cello grade wood that's perforated to absorb, micro perforated, so you don't really see it, but it absorbs sound in a special way. There's acoustical plaster. There are all of these things that the room, you might notice, is not a box. It's configured so that sound is reflected back into the audience, and so that the performers get feedback when they're playing, but just enough so that everybody hopefully is really present in the moment. That's the thing that music is so, it does so magically. I think even for people who've never meditated, have never thought about it, they just intuitively are there.
Wow, I think our dear listener is now thinking, like, I have got to see this thing. So we either have to get them on the 7 Train, or we'll put in the show notes. We'll put some links in the show notes to some sites that have some pictures, some movies, obviously, to the Louis Armstrong House Museum and the Louis Armstrong Center, so you can get tickets to these things. We'll put all that stuff in the show notes. We can't just get people all excited and can't get them hungry and not feed them a meal. We'll do that. Okay, number 6, we got another Regina Bain-ism, which is patience and pushing, the two P's. Tell us about patience and pushing and how that philosophy got you through those 3 months that became 3 years, Regina.
So I think as a personality, I'm a pretty quiet person. sometimes that I can get loud and I've gotten loud on this podcast. So you may be saying, really, are you quiet? I think I am. I'm a pretty quiet person and can sit and have patience and as process happens. But I can also push and make definitive statements and express urgency. And that balance of being able to be patient with a process that has been decades long, be patient with craftsmanship that takes time, be patient, and yet we gotta get it done. And there's a public that's waiting. And so that process for me internally and balancing those parts of my personality in service of this project was definitely helpful. And I think in general, what it means to have a project and balance patience and pushing as you try to get things done, making sure to not be overbalanced in either one of them. Too much pushing will not work. Too much patience will not work.
Mm.
Good advice to any parents.
Oh, yeah, good advice to anybody. Yeah, I'm kind of imagining a seesaw that's just straight across.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so a couple quick ones. Number 7, chapter 7, letter to your earlier self. Sarah, if you could write a short, what do we do now? We don't write letters anymore. We just send each other tweets.
Yes.
What tweet would you send yourself, or what text message or what letter would you write to your former self, the self of, let's see, 18 years ago, before you started this project?
Well, I have something better than my earlier self, which is that Everardo and I are visiting professors in architecture school, and we have 10 wonderful students. And we challenged them to work harder than they'd ever worked and to create, each to design a building that embodies joy. And we asked them to think specifically of the architecture of delight. And I think of all the buildings that we've worked on, we really worked on creating moments of delight, not just one, but after having listened to Lewis's music so many times in the course of this, Everardo had a musician uncle that he called at the start of, before we ever got the project, and he asked him, what did he think was special about Louis Armstrong? And he said, Louis makes me feel always like I want to dance. And so those moments of delight, whether it's lots of different ways that light comes in to the space and how it changes character, depending on the space. And when you look through this golden screen, you see the reflections and the light and Lewis's house shimmering beyond. All of those things, it's very intentional to share and spread the delight and to render it in a physical language that people get the cues from, that they can latch on to. And whether it's for the public or whether it's a quiet space like the conservator's space that looks out on a flowering roof that tilts toward them and invites in birds and butterflies and all kinds of things to remind them that the day can be beautiful.
Mm.
Those are the kinds of things that the music, trying to channel the music into an architecture and trying to share some of this delight that Louis Armstrong is such a genius at sharing delight with people. We learned a lot from that and tried to bring that to our architecture and now try to help young architects do the same.
Now, that is better than writing a letter to your former self. You're writing a letter to your next self. I love that. Let's end on a practical note, Regina. You have spoken before about how to think about your facility after it opens, specifically how to think financially about your facility. We've been very poetic. We've been very philosophical. The three of us have had a little jazz trio today. You've been on trumpet, Sarah's been on keys, and I've just been the drums. But I'm curious, how would you advise others who are going to follow in your footsteps on what to do after people like Sarah or me hand you the keys and kind of walk away? How do you plan fiscally for what's happening? And we'll end chapter 8, another Regina-ism, budget beyond opening. What does that mean? And what lesson would you like to teach other people who are going to do what you do?
Yes. Well, I think any cultural professional who has opened a building knows what that means. This is a $26 million building. And so much fundraising went into making that happen, pushing, patience, pushing to make that $26 million happen. The next $26 million.
Sure.
That's the question. How are you going to make this incredible resource available to your community? That takes people, that takes programs, and that takes funding. And so at every, not only ED, but every funder needs to also think, how am I going to support this organization beyond opening? To guard the investment that has already been made, it has to be continued investment. And so for me, as I was coming into the space and realizing that we needed to do more strategizing around beyond opening, I started to think conservatively about what our program should be in that opening year. Normally, opening year, you want to have it be a bang. And I wanted to make sure that we could be in service for 10 years, for 20, for 50, not just And so I did a budget projection for 7 years out. And based on that budget projection, that told me what we could spend in this year. I'm thankful that we had an incredible grant from the Institute for Museum and Library Services, IMLS, who invested in our opening year programmatically, not the building, but the program. And that is what has allowed us to have such an amazing opening year. But it's very important for both the organization and funders to think beyond the opening and budget for 8-10 years down the road.
And Jargon Watch, when you say program, as a director of a cultural facility, you're talking about the lectures, the events, the things that occur in the building. We've got an architect on the show here. The architect, that word program, means how we allot spaces and adjacencies in the original plan. That word program gets used a lot in many different ways in our business. So that's great advice for the next you. And that brings us to the end of our 8 chapters. I'm going to do a quick recap. Our 8 chapters were Lewis and Lucille's house. Number 2 will open in 3 months. Number 3, a golden curve. Number 4, serious acting. Number 5, the reverberations matter. Number 6, patience and pushing. 50-50. Number 7, a letter to your earlier self. And number 8, budget beyond opening. There's a lot of Regina Bain isms in there. There's a lot of Sarah Caples isms in there. How did we do? Did we get it all out there?
Oh. I think so.
All right. Well, Regina Bain.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Sarah. Regina Bain and Sarah Caples, it's been great to have you both on the show. So a little bit of housekeeping. If listeners would like to get in touch with each of you, what is the best way for them to do that? We'll put your details into the show notes, but let's get them out verbally in case someone's walking the dog, doing the dishes, and they just want to reach out to you. Regina, what's the best way for them to contact you? LinkedIn, website, email? Let's spell it out.
Definitely. You can head to lewisarmstronghouse.org. That's L-O-U-I-S, armstronghouse.org. Sign up for the newsletter, email info@lewisarmstronghouse.org. Reach out to me. I'm also on social media, though I'm not as savvy as many, but I'm there on Instagram and you can check me out there.
Awesome. That's Regina Bain, R-E-G-I-N-A-B-A-I-N on the socials. And Sarah, how about you? What's the best way for people inspired to get right in touch with you or Everardo?
Yeah. So we do have a website, capjeff.com. That's the disco version of Caples Jefferson, C-A-P-J-E-F-F.com.
Yes.
Well, you know, I'm dating myself, but still.
All right, terrific. Well, we'll get that contact information for everybody into the show notes, along with plenty of other things. And I think after listening to all of us talking about this, I think we need to get some links to a little bit of music in the show notes as well.
Awesome.
All right. Okay. I think we covered it. Thank you, dear listener, for your time. In exchange, I hope this episode gave you some news you can use. If you would like to get in touch with me or have an idea for the show, go to makingthemuseum.com and hit contact. You can also find me on LinkedIn under Jonathan Alger, A-L-G-E-R, or at the website of my firm, C&G Partners. And by the way, this podcast has an older sister. It's a one-minute newsletter under the same name, one quick insight each time for museum leaders, exhibition teams, and visitor experience pros. Subscribe also at makingthemuseum.com, big subscribe button in the menu at the top. Meanwhile, I'm Jonathan Alger, and I hope you'll join me next time for Making the Museum. Bye for now.